This podcast brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Russ Niles reporting for AvWeb. We're with Ron Carlson, and he had a remarkable experience during a ferry flight of his TBM Avenger last week. He and his passenger had to bail out over rugged terrain in northeastern Arizona. Ron, how did all this come together?
Well, we were on our second leg. We started from Torrance, California, the goal being to bring it back to Chicago. We landed at an airport in just south of Phoenix, and it was a municipal airport, and very hot there. Got the plane refueled, got back off the ground, and we're probably just past one-third our flight. We're heading towards Albuquerque on the next leg. And it was probably at the worst possible time of what I'll say vulnerability. You know, as pilots, we're always looking down for places to land just in case. And in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I've been watching the last airport 20 miles away, kind of behind me to the north. I'm looking down, and there's just it's just solid trees and mountains. And we're about flying east at 11,500, cheating the 12,000 to get over terrain that was about 9,000 feet. So it didn't feel too bad there, but out of all possible places, there was a big bang in the front, and the whole front of the airplane started shaking, and instantly a lot of dark gray smoke coming straight out of the back of the cowling outlets on top and on both sides, and then I knew we were in some trouble.
Okay, so why not look for a place to set down? There is just no place?
Well, there was a possible place that I was watching. I had one look at to my right on the starboard side, but it was pretty questionable. It was marshy looking. There was water in it. There was a lot of tall sequoia-type trees around it, and I didn't know if it was sloping, but I think more the issue was there was so much smoke, my forward visibility was really restricted, and I thought, my gut was, boy, if this gets worse once you get below a certain altitude, because the engine wasn't really putting out much thrust, so I did throttle it back to try to reduce the smoke. That didn't work. And kind of putting that all together, I just wasn't comfortable to make a wheels-up landing. I think it was more just the forward visibility issue. And once we got below parachute altitude, then it's you're committed and you don't have a choice if things got worse. So that's why I decided that we should exit.
Okay, so what's the procedure? What did you do?
Well, the first thing I did was I motioned for my crewmate, my friend and passenger that was sitting behind me, and we're somewhat separated. And of course, on the intercom was a little the first thing you do is you pull the canopy open, and talking to each other was, and by the way, this is the first time I flew the plane with a passenger, and we've kind of discovered with the intercom system, the configuration, whether the canopy was closed or open, we were having some difficulty understanding each other, so we were passing some notes at certain times. So I was giving the hand motion to bail out, so I waited a few seconds and looked back again, and he was gone. So I double checked to make sure he was out, and then I unhooked my harness, my 4-point harness, and then I pulled back on the stick, and I made a pretty dramatic turn to the right to try to get into a position where I could roll out, and it did work. I mean, I felt a little bit weightless in my seat. I pulled out with my elbow, shoulders, but as I got out, I could feel the slipstream really pulling at me, so I had to really yank my legs up I think my biggest fear was hitting the tail, which happens. I've done a lot of study on this. I've never parachuted before, not in for fun or, you know, all I've done is a lot of study and a lot of videos and just in case. And knowing that, I kind of went into a cannonball position and just kind of clenched my teeth. But I waited about a second. I felt like I was floating with the airplane. I opened my eyes, and I was in a free fall on my back, and I could kind of see a shadow. I'll describe it as kind of a shadow of the plane. It was already kind of by me. And then I knew I was very low, and I had very minimal altitude. I've gone back and checked. I was probably only 1,000 feet because I immediately pulled the D-ring. The parachute executed perfectly. I saw the pilot chute come out, and then it was very shocking experience. Harness, I had my harness on, but I didn't have it super tight, so that didn't help either. When it opened, it deployed. It was a big shock to the body. But I was very relieved, and I was able to take a quick look to my right. I saw my crewmate, Kenny. He was floating down, and I took a look straight ahead, and my thought was, where's the plane? Where's the plane? I didn't want to see where it was going to go because it had all our survival gear and sat phone and ELT, portable ELT, everything you could think of with the food and survival gear, and I didn't see it. And the next thing I looked down, and my feet were, I was coming down in the trees, and my reaction, I remember looking down going, holy cow, these trees are, this is, we're coming down fast here. What I didn't know was Kenny, when he bailed out, he didn't bail out. He got outside the airplane, got on his knees somehow, and there are grip handles on the Avenger on both sides for climbing up on the airplane. He kind of slid down the wing on his back and grabbed onto the recessed, I believe it was the recessed handle, and he was just hanging there on his back with his legs hanging over the where the split flaps are in thin air. And when he said that when I banked the airplane hard to the right, which was for my own getting out, that's when he let go, and that's why we were so close floating down. So it was pretty violent. Went through the trees pretty fast. The parachute, I seemed to slow down a little bit. I was going through all sorts of branches, but the parachute then lost its lift because I remember free-falling the last 20 feet or so and hitting the ground pretty hard. So, and we were on the ground.
So, first parachute jump was a dramatic one, but you survived that, and now you're on a mountain in Arizona. What happened next?
Well, the first thing I did was when I hit, I hit on my butt back and then smashed my head backwards. I had a really good helmet from Aero Classics, and his Kevlar helmet, World War II vintage thing. That saved my head. I got up. I was dazed, but I took the harness off, and I kind of assessed, what I had. And, this is one of what I would say two mistakes I made on this whole thing. The first was I didn't file a flight plan because I had some distractions in the Phoenix area getting off. And then the second mistake is I didn't really have anything in all the little zipper pockets you have. There are so many things that I, in retrospect, I could have put in my flight suit, from a flashlight to a lighter to a knife. So the first thing I tried to do is pull the parachute out of the tree because I'm thinking blanket, SOS, that I knew. Could not, for the life of me, get that parachute out of the tree. It was stuck. So the first thing I did was try to find Ken. I knew it was the bearing, so I hiked a little bit down the mountain and calling his name as loud as I could. I spent about 45 minutes to an hour looking for him. No luck, so I got back to my parachute. Really, all I had was my knee pad, what was left of it, no pen. So I took the notebook paper and I had my wallet and cell phone, which was off, in my breast pocket, and that's pretty much a flight suit and a t-shirt and shoes. So I saw a clearing up the mountain. I marched to that, and lo and behold, when I got it to the clearing, the other side of the clearing, I saw an old logging trail. So that was the first good sign. And by the way this mountain was kind of a desert mountain of pine trees, so sparse, big trees. And you could see, I'm not going to say very far, but like most woods, you could see much farther. So first thing I did was, I had a very sprained left ankle and other injuries, broken rib and things I didn't know at the time, but I spent about 2 hours hiking up that trail to the top of the mountain. I'm not sure it was a good idea because it just took a lot of energy at 9,000 feet and injured. But I wanted to see if I could get a cell signal. I did get a bar up there, but I couldn't get anything out. So I marched back down to where I had placed markers on the trail, logs and paper and stuff. And called out to Kenny a few times, nothing. So I'm like, well, we're going to have to get ourselves out of here. I've got to try and find a search party. The first thing was trying to find water. I was already getting dehydrated. And I dehydrate pretty fast, so I knew I had to find water and get down the mountain. So that's what I did. Hiked a few more miles down. It's starting to get dark, so the first concern was temperature. It was already dropping fast. So I found a small stand of pine trees. I made a pine needle bed and like a pillow in there, and I broke a bunch of pine boughs, maybe 8 or 10, and used as a covering and basically spent the night under that. You know, it took the edge off, but I really couldn't lay still because of my injuries, and I was losing a lot of those in the dark with no flashlight. I could have used my cell phone. I didn't want to use my cell phone power. So by 3 a.m., the moon came up, and I said, well, it's time to move. So I kind of got up and shuffled down the trail as best I could in the moonlight, and I probably made another mile and a half, and then I remember hearing, because I'd stop every once in a while, I remember hearing what sounded like water, and I thought I might have been hallucinating, but it was off to my left, down the mountain, off the trail, so I took the chance, and I got on my butt in the dark, and kind of shuffled on my back and butt down the side of the mountain, over rocks and logs and stuff, and I finally made it down with the water. The sound was getting louder and louder, and then all of a sudden I just kind of popped out onto a real gravel road. So now there's water, there's a gravel road. Now I was feeling really good, like we're going to get out of here. And so make a long story short, I rehydrated. I spent another 4 hours there trying to get my heat, which I couldn't, with another bed with pine needles. When the sun finally came up, I got on the road in the sun. I was warming up, and then all of a sudden I heard a crash to my right up the road, and it was Kenny. My crewmate came tumbling out of he found the same road. So then we were together. So at that point, we just were going up one direction of the road. It was going up the mountain. So we knew going down the mountains, the probable, just from common sense, is probable way out. So we reverse course. Now, at this point, from my neck, back, rib, and ankle injury, I really was having trouble walking too far before an arrest to send him out ahead. He had a major facial injury, which since he's yesterday got out of surgery, had 5 plates put in his cheek, and he had a wrist injury, but his legs were good, so he was able to make a few miles. And he found a truck with 2 forestry guys from the Indian Reservation from White River, and they came up and got me, radioed, next thing you know, an ambulance, first responders, all of that. So they were great. And we got out of there.
Wow. Remarkable story. You still haven't found the airplane, though, right?
No. And what was eerie is... when Kenny, when he bailed and he was floating down, he said he watched me bail out. And after I came out, I had this thing in between a 50 and 70 degree climbing turn. And he said, once I came out, the airplane almost, you know, of course, it was trimmed for level flight at the beginning. He said it just, it kind of lazily eerily return, not to quite to level flight, but it kind of righted itself and kept descending. And then, of course, he hit the trees. Now, we didn't hear any explosion. We were looking for a fire, nothing. So it's kind of like a ghost plane, because there were two helicopters looking for it within hours the next day, and no one's found it.
So what's next for you? Are you going to be looking for another vintage aircraft? You're quite the adventurer, so I don't imagine this is going to slow you down.
No, I'm not afraid to fly and all of that. I really want to find this airplane. My heart and my blood and passion is this particular airplane, its history, and all the work we put into it. My gosh, in the last year, we did the radio room. We put replica machine guns in the wings with propane oxygen systems to fire, simulate fire. The turret, we put so much work into this thing. I want to find this airplane. And what they told me is the NSTB and the FAA, they're like, well, we're trying to pull some favors. We're not going to be doing any searching. The fire, the Indian reservation people took a quick look, but no one's searching for it. So I think this summer we're going to try to, a lot of my friends have volunteered to go on 4x4 and do ground searches. So perhaps this summer, I really want to find this plane. This plane is, I feel really, I mean, it's part of me. I got to find this thing.
Well, we really appreciate your time today, Ron. It's Russ Niles reporting for AvWeb. Thanks for listening.